You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We are very pleased today to have a very special presentation on the topic of the rise of populism in Europe and its implications for human rights and the European Union's Fundamental Rights Agency. We really couldn't have two better people here to speak about these issues. My name is Jim Goldston. I'm the director of the Open Society Justice Initiative, and Open Society Foundations generally is deeply invested in the situation in Europe and is concerned by some recent developments there, which we'll be talking about. We have seen a host of challenges to democracy and human rights. It was a couple of years ago now, I believe, that Hungary's prime minister literally celebrated the term illiberalism and pointed to inspiration from places like Russia and China and other authoritarian models in contrast to the democratic West. And that's been followed up by troubling actions in respect of NGOs and civil society and independent media. We've seen troubling developments in Poland with respect to the respect for the independence of the judiciary. We have seen deep animosity to migration and enormous political ramifications from that, feeding forces of intolerance. And in a number of countries, there has been deepening skepticism, if not outright hostility, to the very fundamental regional human rights frameworks and international human rights frameworks that emerged after the Second World War, including in respect of the European Court of Human Rights and, of course, the European Union itself. And these developments have important implications for Europe, but they also have implications for the rest of the world, given the European Union's traditional role as a model for embodying human rights and democratic values and its power diplomatically around the world in influencing others. So we're here to talk about these issues, try to understand what's happening. And we're very pleased that Michael O'Flaherty is with us, the director of the European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights. Michael previously was a professor of human rights law and director of the Irish Center for Human Rights at the National University of Ireland in Galway. He has served as chief commissioner of the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission and is a member of the United Nations Human Rights Committee. And he's previously held senior posts for the United Nations, including in Sierra Leone and Bosnia long ago, which is where I met Michael, and his was a rare voice of sanity and practical common sense in a place where those were in short supply. Michael is going to open with a presentation, and then we'll get comments from Felice Gare, and many of you will know Felice Gare directs the Jacob Blaustein Institute for the Advancement of Human Rights of the American Jewish Committee. Felice has served as the vice chair of the United Nations Committee Against Torture. She has, since 2000, been a member of the, and including chair three times, of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, and she's really one of the leading experts on international human rights here in the United States and around the world. So welcome to you both. We will start with Michael, get comments from Felice. I will then ask some questions, and then we'll open it up the floor. And I think we've got some folks on phone as well. So if they're there, we'll open it up to you guys as well. So Michael, please.
Jim, thank you very much indeed. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm most grateful to the Open Society Foundations for hosting the event today. I'm grateful to Felice and to the Jacob Blaustein Institute for their support also. Jim suggested that before I get to our topic, it might be prudent to say a word about what the Fundamental Rights Agency is. If you don't mind this rather unspectacular opening point, just to give you the basics. The EU Fundamental Rights Agency is an independent body of the European Union, separate from the decision-making institutions, with the task of advising the EU and its member states to support them to be human rights compliant in the work that they do within the European Union. So we don't have any role externally. It's with regard to the situation inside the territories of the 28 member states. We're 10 years old, based in Vienna. We do our work through quite a wide range of tools, and I've seen some of our publications there, so you have the outputs of some of those tools with you. The best known area of work of the agency is its surveys. We do the biggest human rights surveys in the world. We also publish reports of what we call socio-legal analysis. We look at areas of problematic from a human rights point of view, legal systems across the European Union, and we assess not just the provisions of the law, but how it works in practice. We produced a report on surveillance laws in Europe just 2 days ago, which uses this socio-legal method. We are persistently delivering legal advice to the European Union institutions, in particular the European Parliament. And we've, for example, delivered numerous opinions around the reform of the asylum and migration laws that has been occurring over the last couple of years. We do public reporting on situations of particular sensitivity, organized thematically. And so that's the basis on which we publish a monthly report on the human rights dimensions of the migration crisis as it affects the 14 most impacted EU member states. We support the EU and its member states with so-called technical cooperation, assisting them to put in place better practices to promote and protect human rights. And we invest heavily in awareness raising, or to put it more grandly, in supporting the development of a culture of human rights inside the EU. So that's us in a nutshell. But let me turn now to our topic of the day. And I'm not going to waste time arguing that there is a populist problem in Europe. There is a populist problem in Europe. So let's not rest there. We have a problem, and it's growing. Before recent elections, some 20% of Europe's population voted for a populist party or a populist government. That figure is I don't know what it is today, but it's higher as a result of the elections that have taken place in recent months. So more interesting than determining whether we have an issue is to understand why we have that issue. And I'd like to suggest to you that it's not particularly difficult, to my mind, to understand how we got to where we are right now in Europe. In the first place, even while we acknowledge that Europe is extraordinarily diverse, and those of you who are European or who know Europe would appreciate this, we have a very diverse set of societies. But within that diversity, there are some common concerns. One of them is an unease in the general population across wide swathes of the European Union about a sense of either losing out vis-a-vis others or at the same time seeing what they consider to be a familiar world under threat. So losing out, a sense of being under threat, is with some other being defined as the problem, is quite commonplace. It's closely linked to intergenerational problems of growing patterns of economic inequality and of economic disadvantage. And here again, there's an othering, in particular a sense of elites that run these societies with little regard to or appreciation for the levels of economic inequality. Features such as this have been dramatically exacerbated by the migration crisis, if that's what you want to call it. We call it a crisis of migration policy, which is a rather different configuration of the phenomenon. And all of this, then, is whipped up by opportunistic politicians in at least some places. But while it is only being opportunistically exploited in some places, it's having an impact in all places, in as much as it is undoubtedly shifting politics towards the right. Into all of this complexity, we see serious concerns with regard to patterns of human rights abuse, and we see human rights itself, the system, the laws, the institutions, being presented as the problem, or as part of the problem. And so what is this impact for human rights? That's my particular focus. I'm not some generic European society specialist. My agency doesn't have that role. Our narrow concentration is on supporting the better promotion and protection of human rights. So what is the impact of these patterns of populism for human rights? Well, our work at the Fundamental Rights Agency on a daily basis is throwing up evidence of a very worrying situation. And if I could take, there was a really great article in Monday's International New York Times. I have the name of the author here somewhere, Max Fisher, who he was writing. He's writing about Myanmar, but I thought some of the analysis could be transferable anywhere. And he spoke about he asked, what are the canaries in the mine when it comes to democracy? You know, the tests of the cleanliness of the air deep down in that mine. And he said that the canaries are the situation of minorities, the freedom of the press, and the situation of activists. So not a bad framing in terms also of what we're talking about in Europe. So let me, in terms of the patterns of human rights concern, let me take briefly each of those three categories. Firstly, the situation of minorities. We're worried about the situation of minority groups in Europe based on our survey work. We've just now completed one of the largest surveys we've ever undertaken on the patterns of discrimination against minorities in Europe. We've already published information on the situation of Roma and of Muslims, and we will produce all of our findings comprehensively this coming December. But firstly, Roma, where we published the tranche of findings last year. And we found that Europe's largest minority is suffering unacceptable levels of abuse in a context of a failure over time of policies to improve their situation in society. Shocking levels of unemployment, of de facto segregation in schools and houses, and in fact, a community with regard to which it is acceptable still in Europe today to be racist. Quite a shocking thing to have to say. But a very, very worrying situation, including in terms of patterns of assault, intimidation, and harassment. Turning to Muslims, where we published our survey findings just 2 weeks ago, we're similarly worried. We surveyed migrant Muslims, not indigenous Muslims, in Europe. And among the migrant Muslim community, we identified that at least one in four members of these communities has been subjected to some form of harassment or discrimination within the past year, and that almost none of these acts are reported to the authorities. Curiously, by the way, and paradoxically, let me just say in passing, it's not relevant to my theme, but a very interesting finding from the Muslim survey, beyond the levels of intimidation, harassment, discrimination, was that Muslims exhibit a greater trust in the state than is to be found in the general population. That's, by the way, a rather hopeful element of these findings, but again, not our primary concern today. But let me stay with migrants and a brief word with regard to the situation of that other category of minority in Europe, the migrants who've come in the current crisis wave. Here, we're repeatedly seeing serious problems. We published just 2 weeks ago a report on reception conditions across the 14 most affected member states, and they're not acceptable. There are problems in all 14 countries, notwithstanding some achievements over recent times, and these are at least in part motivated by the populist repudiation of the other, who is the migrant. One other dimension of the negative impact for migrants in this current climate in Europe is, of course, the famous failure to accept migrants for relocation across EU member states, leaving an insupportable and unconscionable burden for Italy and Greece in particular to bear. The one last group, minority group I'd mentioned before moving on, is Jews. The Fundamental Rights Agency published the most significant survey of the experience of discrimination and harassment by members of the Jewish community already some 6 years ago, and the results were not good. The laws were not so bad in many places, but the experience of the Jewish community was one of fear and marginalization. And we know that the problems persist. I met with the European Jewish Council just a few days ago, and I was reminded of the extent to which this community feels under threat in some parts of Europe, to an extent where there's a worry that people will actually leave the European Union. And it's on the basis of such worries as that we will do a new survey of the Jewish community next year, with results to be published in late 2018. But I'm not very optimistic about what that survey will find. So minorities, problems in the EU. Turning to the second of those three canaries, the state of the media. We were all appalled 2 weeks ago with that dreadful assassination in Malta. I'm sure you're all aware. Thank goodness within the EU such acts are extremely rare. But their rarity shouldn't distract from the extent to which media is under attack, is under pressure across a number of EU member states. We did a report on this last year in the context of an initiative by the European Commission in which we identified patterns of intimidation and harassment and of hate, both on and offline, but particularly online, to a worrying degree. By the way, with a predominant targeting of women media practitioners. Women journalists fare much worse than men in the context, for example, of online hate speech. And just last week, I spoke to EU foreign ministers gathered in what's called the EU General Affairs Council on another dimension of the concerns about the state of the media, and that is the concentration of media ownership, which is a serious problem across most EU member states. And that's according to the Media Pluralism Monitoring Project that's run out of the European University Institute in Florence. And then third and finally, in terms of the three canaries in the mine, civil society. We in Europe are used to speaking about a shrinking civil society space that is somewhere else. And it's high time that we recognise the extent to which it's our problem as well. We conducted research work in recent months, which will lead to a publication of ours on the 5th of December on the EU's own shrinking civil society. We've identified across the EU an interplay of regulatory pressure, financial pressure, and direct forms of attack in some places that is seeking to cow civil society and to reduce its critical role for healthy democracies. So, we've got a populist issue. It's impacting for human rights. Let me, in my final remarks, turn briefly to what we can do. And again, I'll frame my comments in the limited space of an agency that has the role of standing up for human rights. I'd be the first to acknowledge that an agency such as ours and human rights specialists in general can only contribute to resolving problems of the type that I've just mentioned. But the fact that we have a limited space in no way reduces the importance of acting energetically in that limited space. And by the way, let me say before giving you a few examples of what we can do, I should be honest with you and say that I'm optimistic. We're not in a good place, but I do think we can see a way to a better situation if we're all sufficiently engaged and focused. So, briefly, and I won't go into detail on these because we can come back to them later in discussion. Six areas where we could take action, better action. The first has to do with, and this is because it's the most urgent and important, is doing a better job of protecting human rights actors, be they in NGOs, be they in the media, or wherever else they might be. And that's the basis on which my agency will put some recommendations in our December report on such things as doing a better job of monitoring and of engaging the issues when and where they occur, and doing a much better job in Europe of providing core funding for organisations that are doing such vital work. We need to insist that authorities better protect journalists who are under threat. Basic protection, but also through prosecution of crime, where crime is perpetrated against them. I said media, but more generally as well, because we have far too much information about attacks that go without serious investigation and, of course, without prosecution. And then the final element of strengthening the protective space has to do with strengthening Europe's national human rights institutions and its equality bodies, among others. But second, beyond protecting the actors, it's very important that we re-engage or engage with Europe's general populations around issues of human rights. For example, we have to do a better job of showing that human rights is about everybody. It's not just, it is about minorities. It is about the people on the margins, but it's also about everybody. It's about all of us, and we must do a better job of re-engaging with all of us. And one obvious way to do this is by paying significantly more attention to the promotion of economic rights in a context of inequality, as I've just described it. Now, there's a typically Europeanly complex initiative right now, unhelpfully named the European Pillar of Social Rights. Please don't ask me to explain it in any great detail, but it is a really important current vehicle within which we can perhaps make some progress in promoting economic rights of everybody. And then the only other point I'd make in terms of engaging the general population is that we in Europe have to reinvest in civic education, whereby an effort is made across the education system of instilling a sense of values and of rights, something which is notably neglected in the curricula and the syllabi in many, some at least, EU member states. The third of the six suggestions as to how to push back is that those of us who promote human rights approaches, human rights solutions, have to get off our high horse and get down on the ground and make the business case for our claims. We have to demonstrate empirically that the way we're saying the action should be taken or the saying what action should be taken lead to better outcomes for society. This is a big part of the work of our agency. For example, we're deeply involved in the security debates in Europe, arguing, I think, with some effect, that it isn't a zero-sum game between human rights and strong security. We need strong security, but human rights, respectful security, will actually be better security, supporting more stable societies. Fourth of my six, we must challenge the myths wherever we see them. I was watching, I don't know why I keep admitting this, but I was watching Fox News this morning in my hotel room, and I was just so taken aback, because it's not something I watch in Europe. I was so taken aback with the level of myth. And let's go back to where I should more safely talk Europe. We must, wherever a myth is presented which feeds populism and undermines human rights, challenge it with hard data. And that's why gathering the data is so important. And it's why we at the Fundamental Rights Agency put so much of our resources into statistics and surveys and things of that nature. One example, and I'll move on. When the attacks, the sexual violence attacks took place in Cologne in Germany back a year and a half ago, where migrants undoubtedly harassed young women, a myth was perpetrated out of that action to the effect that migrants were bringing sexual violence to Europe. Nonsense. We were able to represent survey findings of ours on violence against women to remind, through the European media, that we have a serious problem of sexual violence, but it's an indigenous one. And so that's an example of challenging myths where you find it. Fifth of the sixth, we who care about human rights, who work for human rights, need to build new alliances. There are possibilities to engage with actors with whom we might otherwise ignore. There are opportunities that must be taken more vigorously and energetically. One obvious example is partnership with the business community, but that, relatively speaking, has received a certain amount of attention. So I won't say more about it now. But let me suggest other communities where the potential for cooperation has been rather neglected. Two, which my agency is engaging with right now, are on the one hand faith communities, how we can find the shared common space to work together towards shared goals, and there are a lot of shared goals, and we need to rediscover that shared space with faith communities while never once diminishing the complexity and the issues that will coexist with such cooperation. And secondly, the arts world. At the Fundamental Rights Agency, we believe strongly that there's untapped potential for human rights and artistic practitioners to work together for better societies. So build better and new alliances. And finally, sixth of my suggestions has to do with how we communicate. We are of the view at my agency that we as part of a larger human rights community, have not done as good a job as we should in communicating our messages in a way that they are effectively received and impact people. And so we have to look at how we frame our messages, which values we engage, how we personalize, how we respectfully and appropriately engage empathy as well as the intellect, and how we learn from other contexts of messaging so that we can do a better job. So I leave it there. That was super brief, but I realize we're going to have a long conversation, and perhaps we can pick some of those items up in due course. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael, for those provocative comments. Put a lot on the table. I think we'll first ask Felice, who brings all her vast international human rights perspective to this discussion, for any comments.
Thank you very much, Jim. Thank you to OSI, Jay, and thank you, Michael. Clearly, everything that's been said is a problem and something that needs to be dealt with. What are the complaints and who's responsible for this? Well, I think one thing we need to do is ask, well, what is it that people who are complaining about human rights are saying about it? Is human rights part of the problem or part of the solution? It's clearly, as Michael has indicated, part of the solution. But it's also been viewed as part of the problem. One of the key complaints is about safety. People want to be safe from terrorists and violence and terrorism. And they complain that the human rights movement, that the human rights organizations are biased on the side of protecting the terrorists, the people who use violence, and not worrying about the victims. That's complaint number one. Complaint number two deals with, Michael cited the economic inequalities, people who feel that tradition, custom, culture is under attack and that it's human rights that's out there doing the attacking. And people want to reassert traditional hierarchies and values, and the way they do that is particularly when challenged by the other. And whether the other is a migrant or a Jew or a Muslim or a Roma or anybody else, a woman, anybody else coming into the picture, they feel that, again, the human rights world is on their side and not on the side of the ordinary person who feels that he or she is being already threatened by economic inequality and safety, and now by the other. It's a scapegoat type approach that follows. And then finally, there's another element to this, which is quite common to populism, which is the idea that it's outsiders that are ruling us. The people who are in this human rights world, they are in these foreign organizations. Or worse, they're in these European organizations that are ruling us from Brussels or Vienna or wherever. And they're elites, they're lawyers, some of them are foreigners, or very remote politicians from international institutions. We're not in charge, and they don't care about us. Now, this is a classic element of populist ideology and promotion, is to talk about the real people and them, the elites, and that's used by all the populist politicians. In the case of human rights, they've got several different elites, and it's also focused on both on the elite lawyers, but also on the elite institutions, the international entities that have been so important to the very fiber of international human rights law and advocacy. They are seen as part of the problem. In the case of the European Fundamental Rights Agency, I suppose all of the above would probably be checked off by those people who want to promote a populist argument like this. Now, the question Michael raises is, what should human rights organizations and international organizations do about this? And he set out six very good suggestions. We can talk about the particulars of those points. But there is also really another element that I think that you didn't touch on, which is that populists themselves don't see democracy as necessarily what they want to see. Because if the real people, their people, are in charge, you don't need these complicated procedures, votes, bureaucrats, politicians. In fact, you have to get rid of dissent if you're in a populist mode, because you've got to clean out the government, you've got to clean out the institutions, and you've got to clean out even your own parties in some cases. And this is very common among populist leaders right now. And if you go back in history, you'll see the same thing. Whether it's history of Europe or the history of the U.S. or other parts of the world, you'll see this dissatisfaction with democracy and democratic norms. In the early 20th century, it was liberal democracy that was challenged. Guess what's being questioned now in all the halls of populist power? Liberal democracy. Is liberalism dead? Is liberal democracy, does it offer anything more for us anymore? And that's because populism really is antithetical, speaks in the name of the people, but doesn't want to see the people's views or representation, because they've already decided that they represent the singular path. Michael spoke about taking into account people's economic rights and people who feel that they've been left behind by globalization and the economic changes because of that. And that's a really very big and important element that needs more attention. But the other piece of that is this fear and resentment, the scapegoating of minorities and migrants. And particularly, if you put the two of them together, it's a toxic cocktail. And we've, as the High Commissioner for Human Rights said just the other day at our institute, we've seen this before. And it's a toxic cocktail. There also are criticisms of the actual content of international law and human rights law on issues like the use of force. When is it appropriate or not appropriate to use it, particularly in the context of terrorism and violence? And again, there's a feeling that the human rights folks are not seeing things the same way as the populists would like to see it on those kinds of issues. Here in the U.S., we have a president who said he thinks torture is perfectly appropriate, and in fact, he thinks it's effective. This is a breakdown of our constitutional principles. This is a breakdown of international obligations and assurances. It's just a breakdown of the whole understanding of the rule of law and the international rule of law, but it going right to the heart of some of the basic principles. Finally, we have international institutions that are under attack. The ICC is seeing African states withdraw from it, not Europeans, but Africans. We have attacks in the UK on the European Court of Human Rights, and you have a prime minister who says law gets in the way, human rights gets in the way, and when it does, we're not going to pay attention to it. So you have fragile international institutions, fragile international legal norms, and you have attacks as well on civil society, which Michael spoke about. You put this all together, and it's absolutely classic populist revolt, populist ideology in each of these concerns. So pay attention to economic inequality and other inequalities. Pay attention to broadening the base, as Michael suggested. do a better job of explaining why rights are good for everyone, victims and people who are what we call them bystanders, that what happens at the local level and what happens at the international level are related. That's something I think that we didn't talk about, and that's something that we need to do a much better job of explaining with regard to the whole question of populism in Europe or anywhere else. Thank you.
Super. Thank you very much, Felice. So you both put a lot here. I want to start, if I can, by asking, Michael, picking up on something you said, and actually Felice just adverted to that, actually. So you, one of your responses, I think, was about what should be done. You said you need to respond to myth with facts, with data. You do your surveys, your statistics, hard facts. Police just talked about reason, explanation, right? Explain to people how they are. But we've learned, have we not? I mean, the human rights movement is not at a loss for facts in lots of places, and it hasn't been in recent years. We've got all the facts we need about what's going on in Syria, and nothing is happening. People have a lot of facts in Hungary, in Poland, about what their governments are doing. Some could say in this country as well, and people are accepting those facts and voting accordingly. Some people have suggested, based on recent developments in cognitive science, that facts are not enough. Not only that they're not enough, they're not even very helpful in terms of advocacy. The way people think, the way we, human beings, think, doesn't respond to facts as such, certainly not to collective data. You need to appeal to emotion, to instinct, to aspects of human understanding that go beyond the rational. Any sense in that, or you think that's just ridiculous? And if so, what are the implications for human rights organizations which have traditionally relied on fact-based reports to get their job done?
The very last term you use, fact-based reports, I think comes to the heart of things, because we have to distinguish knowledge and gathering of information and the communication. And it's when we get to the communication, we get to issues of how do you effectively transmit the message. I'll come back to that in a moment, but let me start by saying that the repudiation of facts, the proliferation of fake data, and things of that nature should never lead us to conclude that we no longer need facts. That's a point I think I'd be never willing to concede. But before I get there, to say also that I don't agree with you, Jim, that we have all the information. We don't. Time and time again, when we undertake surveys, we're surprised by what we find. It's counterintuitive. It's not what we expected. Take, for example, work we did a few years back on the situation of LGBT people in Europe. We were of the view that we would, it was before my time, we institutionally were of the view that we'd see problems in some parts of Europe, but not in others. And in a couple of countries, we'd basically give a clean bill of health. Well, we discovered through survey work that there is not one EU member state, not one, where more than 50% of gay people are willing to hold hands in public. Now, we didn't expect that. And that's a reminder that we may think we know what's going on, but that's not at all the case. I won't bore you, but I could repeat those examples for just about every survey we've ever undertaken. So, firstly, we don't know what's going on. We do need the hard, solid data generated through empirical research. And then, armed with that, we have the task of effectively communicating our messages. And those messages will be worded and framed differently whether we're sending them to policymakers or out there into society. And there we certainly have to do a much better job. We do need to engage with the bits of the brain that convince us. We brought a bunch of experts to Vienna a couple of months ago, cognitive scientists, epistemologists, people from ad agencies, spin doctors from the world of politics, and we said to them, we're doing a bad job, help us get it right. And on that basis, actually the report is in the public domain, it's on our website. We got some really smart new thinking about how to communicate better. I'll give an example and then I'll stop. It seems there's a certain number of values which appeal out there in society, and some of us and those values range from order to equality, justice, things of this nature. Different values appeal to different parts and segments of the population. In the human rights world, we tend typically to create messaging that engages values such as equality and justice, but not which engage values such as security and order. So one of the challenges before us is to examine whether we can and how we can also speak to people for whom those values are more significant. And some really interesting things going on right now, and I'm quite encouraged regarding the direction we're going.
Excellent. If we can keep this conversation on a point of hope rather than despair, I'll be thrilled. Felice, anything you want to say about this issue about how to best appeal or the role of facts versus emotion in this discussion?
Well, I just wanted to add that a lot of the human rights movement activity is based on emotion. We pick out the individual case in human rights advocacy because it has more impact than the broad statistics. As human rights groups, we really don't gather information on discrimination. What the Fundamental Rights Agency is doing now is actually a great service to us. We gather some cases of discrimination that are worthy enough to talk about, and then we highlight them in these reports. But we don't do across-the-board surveys of any kind. When we have information like what Michael just said about in the Muslim survey that they've just completed at the FRA, that in the Muslim survey, Michael said that the results show that in every country, Muslims have more confidence in the state and the state's authorities than other people at large. If I'm not mistaken, the people interviewed were new. They were from special communities, and many of them were new migrants. Am I right about that?
No, they were, it's a strange term, but they were old migrants.
Okay. Yeah. All right, then that kills my argument. My argument was going to be, if I was a new migrant and somebody came and interviewed me, I'd say that I believed in the state. Okay, because who else am I going to turn to in that situation? So we have to interpret these surveys more. But the human rights movement focuses on emotions. But we don't necessarily do it as well as we did. Who is the symbol of human rights today? Who is the Mandela? Who is the Anne Frank? Who is the pick a Soviet dissident, Natan Sharansky? Who is the person that people look to and say this guy needs to, this woman needs to be freed? This person is suffering immeasurably. We don't have a lot of people like, I mean, if you work on a particular country, of course, you know all the names. But in terms of popular understanding and knowledge, we don't have those kinds of symbols in quite the way that the movement did in earlier years, because we're more involved in more cases, more situations. We have more reports. We have more information. Too much information. That's the problem of the digital age, and it's not an unfamiliar problem in the human rights world either. Second point on the emotional issue is, after all, populists are engaged at an emotional level with conspiracy theories, with fantasies of a variety of kinds. They are moralist usually, and some would say monist. That is to say, they have a simple, single we-they view of the world, and believe that they represent the common good, and that there is no legitimate opposition to that good. Now, that's a very stereotyped view of what is a populist, but it is what these movements have seen and brought in the past, and that is heavily emotional. We don't have that kind of emotion. We have hard, cold facts. We have laws. We have lawyers. We have international institutions, and we're distant from them. We need to get back to us. I agree that we need to get back to a certain extent to educating, but appealing to the emotion as well as the rationality of all people if we want human rights to regain its primacy.
Michael, you wanted to add to that?
Just briefly, Felice reminded me, it's important. Within the human rights community, we can have a diversity of roles. Within the human rights community, we can have a diversity of roles, and the key is to cooperate appropriately. There will always be a role for dry survey producers such as ourselves. And then it's your job, other people in that community, to take our findings and put a face on them. We won't always put that face, but the materials are made available so that the face can be placed. Example was given there of our findings on Roma. They're shocking and they're disturbing, but they're not drilled down to an individual in a village. I've been in the villages, as many of you. I've been in Roma homes, 8 kids on top of each other in a tiny room inside, a hovel without running water, where they have to use the garden as a latrine. But we're not the best place to be persistently telling those stories. But instead, within a collaboration, the different parts of the human rights community can pull together to bring the best impact.
I wonder, we're talking about how to best appeal to the public or the various publics. Why is that important? And I don't mean to be naive, but do we risk something? So let me start again. Human rights, in some views, is inherently a minority enterprise. It is the defense of unpopular causes, and we should be unapologetic about that, right? People who are accused of horrific crimes are entitled to due process and the best defense, and it doesn't mean if anybody likes them or they get popular, et cetera, right? So human rights, it's in the DNA of the human rights movement, not necessarily to seek majority support for its views, and that in no way vitiates the value of the cause. So is there something problematic about trying to be, when we say be more effective in our communication, about trying to appeal to popular majorities to support the cause?
Jim, unpopularity hasn't done us very well. If we were to characterize ourselves in the way you characterize us, which I know you did just to be provocative, we were on the pathway to ruin. As we lose one by one the constituencies of support that are vital for the project to continue to thrive. But also, human rights is not just about the minorities on the edges, those we don't like or that the society doesn't like. Yes, it is, of course, about them, but it's about everybody. It's, in a way, if I may borrow a term, it's a social contract within society. And again, coming back to the specific context of Europe, it's the fabric which allowed Europe to thrive, in large part to thrive, after the Second World War. It hasn't got a future if it doesn't have the buy-in of significant numbers, majorities even, of people in Europe. Human rights are their human rights, and we have to bear some of the responsibility for having failed to maintain that sense of ownership over the decades.
I think that Michael's absolutely right here. After World War II, the buy-in, for example, from the churches, from the Roman Catholic Church, was absolutely essential to getting the Universal Declaration. The concept of dignity, the concept of having people behind this issue was considered enormously important. I have been reflecting on the fact, I'm going to go back to my first point about the safety issue. We have in the United Nations a fund for victims of torture. And the United States government funds $6-8 million a year and has for at least 20 years for this fund for victims of torture, which is not a transparent fund. It's an eminently important thing to address victims of a crime, particularly a crime perpetrated principally by agents of a state or of states. We don't have a fund anywhere in the human rights world for victims of terrorism. Is terrorism a human rights violation? Can it be? Are there cases where it is, where the state is giving is complicit in those acts, or doesn't do an anyway? You can find the link to the state if you want. That the state may not be the perpetrator of the terrorism, but it may be the state may be the agent that owes something to the victims. Does the human rights community? Should we have something like that? Should we be thinking about other kinds of victims, victims of violence? We're quick to run out there and defend the defenseless and defend those who are unjustly accused and unjustly persecuted, and we're right to do that. But should we also be there to assist, defend, call for the support of victims victims of violence who cannot receive reparation from the perpetrators because the perpetrators are either uncaptured or unknown or indigent.
Thank you. I'm going to ask one more question, then I want to throw it open and so ask people to start thinking of what, if anything, they'd like to say or ask. Michael, you just referred to the social contract, that human rights are for everyone. I want to ask this question specifically about Europe, and this will reflect my ignorance, surely. But in some ways, Europe in particular had a stronger social contract than some other places. One might point to the United States. And some analysts have suggested that the existence of that stronger social contract, the stronger protections for workers, for people who were not working, for people who had various disabilities or other problems, was precisely because a number of core European Union societies were at least perceived by their citizens as being relatively ethnically homogeneous. And the transformation of those societies over recent decades, as more and more migrants have come, initially thought to work temporarily, but in fact to live and bring their families, understandably, has changed the nature of the social contract. And people who previously were willing to say, well, of course, I'm happy to pay taxes to provide some welfare for that person who looks like me or has a name like mine or comes from the same background as I do ethnically, I'm not sure I'm willing to do that for somebody who, in fact, has come from some other place in the world. So is there a greater challenge to the social contract today in Europe because of the growing diversity of Europe's population? And if so, what to do about that?
That's an interesting analysis, and I'm not really equipped to comment on that. But nevertheless, there's undoubtedly an increasing closing of the space in terms of the generosity expressed in our societies. But I come back again to the issue of fact and myth. And a lot of the perceptions as to he or she will take my job, he or she is emptying our social welfare pool, is not founded in reality. The figures are really quite dramatically different to perceptions. For example, the 360-something thousand migrants arrived in Europe in 2015. The Union has a population of 500 million. And so I'm not a great mathematician, but that 360-something thousand to 500 million is tiny. It's tiny. And when the discourse is confronted with some facts, it's left looking rather hollow and empty. Again, typically on the streets of Europe, when quick surveys are done as to perceptions, what percentage of the population of this or that society is foreign-born, is Muslim, or whatever else the question might be, the typical reaction on the street is dramatically higher than the actual statistical reality. And so to improve the discourse around issues such as this, we have to keep injecting facts. I won't go back over the earlier conversation about how you inject those facts, but it's got to be done. We've got to, as I said earlier, we have to reinvest in civic education. I was quite surprised when I came into this role, because this is something I wouldn't have had occasion to look at previously, to see the extent to which there has There has been a decline in what you might call generically civic education in the school programs in Europe. What you might assume as a given isn't happening. Schooling on ethics, schooling on good citizenship. I don't even need us to talk about schooling on human rights. Maybe that's a, you know, kids can get that through an ethical framework in the classroom or whatever else. But it's badly neglected, and it needs a surge of attention right now.
Thank you. Police?
Well, unfortunately, scapegoating is all too familiar, and it's not just in Europe. It's throughout the world. And we will see that. And that people will revert to that as an argument for indecent conduct towards other people is just one of the sad realities that we're facing right now. Michael's absolutely right that we need to invest heavily in public education, but smart education. We need to use modern media. We need to be more proactive in this regard. Books and films are all fine, but, you know, what did I hear yesterday? 65% of the American people get all their information, all their news from social media today. I mean, these are staggering figures. We need to do that. 70 years ago, when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted, Eleanor Roosevelt, the American, the wife of the wartime president of the United States and the first chair of the UN Commission on Human Rights, said the destiny of human rights is in the hands of all of our people in all of our communities. It's a really simple concept. That was in her Small Places, Close to Home speech. And the truth of the matter is that sometimes you have to work at the retail level and not just at the wholesale level.
Felice twice mentioned the local level, and I just want to jump in to completely agree with her. We've too often engaged in terms of human rights promotion with the capital. We've got to get to the village. And we have to figure out ways to get to the village. There's a very interesting initiative called Human Rights Cities, which we're seeking to support in Europe, in recognition that most people in Europe live in cities. But there's also the rural local level, and we've got to find ways for the human rights system to deliver benefits that you can see and feel at the local level. When I was running the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission, I went into a small town. And we used to organize town hall meetings in all the boroughs of Northern Ireland. And I remember in one, I was going on about what we do this and what we do that. And a lady took to the floor and said, "Yes, well, what are you going to do about the trash collection on my street?" And that was a very legitimate question. That mattered for her. And I had to come up with an answer. I did come up with an answer. But the point is we need to be aware of those questions and be responding in a meaningful way.
Super. Thank you both very much. So, colleagues, can I invite questions, comments? And I think we've got a microphone that is going to circulate, and I see someone in the back. Yes, hold it close, please. And if you could identify yourself before speaking. Thank you.
Thanks very much. That was an excellent presentation. I'm Duncan Wilson from the Public Health Program here at Open Society Foundations. Michael, you spoke a lot about the human rights impacts of the rise of populism. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the contribution of the denial of human rights to the rise in populism and the breach at times of what you called the social contract in Europe in the last several years. And I'm thinking particularly about austerity policies as a political choice in response to the economic global recession, and perhaps some lessons not just for individual member states but also for European Union institutions in relation to their contribution and encouragement of states of adopting such harsh austerity policies.
Thank you. Do you want to, should we take a couple, or you want to, why don't we do that? Why don't we take two or three? So you've got one there, I see.
Shauna Smolin with the Jacob Blaustein Institute. Speaking about dispelling myths, I'm curious if there's been any additional thought to what vehicles would be best suited for providing that message in an environment of hostility towards facts and fake news allegations flying on all sides, who would be the best, whether it's the human rights community or others, to deliver those messages of truth, fact, and dispelling of myth?
Super. Thank you. Why don't we take one more in this round?
I'm Michelle Gallo with the grant-making support group here at the Open Society Foundations. You spoke a little bit earlier about the closing space for civil society in Europe, yet your optimism for human rights in general. I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit more about what you see the effects of this shrinking space for civil society, and what people who are concerned about this can do to support those organizations as they are coming under attack by governments or facing increased restrictions and regulations for their work.
Great, thank you. Michael?
Thanks. Firstly, the austerity policies. I wasn't in this role back in that period. So I won't speak about what the agency has or hasn't done to engage the issue. I'll tell you that I was struck at the time as an observer that discussions were not happening within Europe, which would have been standard if it was in the context of development policies with regard to African states. And I thought we have so much to learn. Europe has so much to learn from elsewhere. And we have to do a better job of being Europe in the world, including allowing for the advances that have been achieved to some extent in World Bank context, for example, to be replicated in Europe. So that's as much as I would say on that. But I wanted to engage one other dimension of denial of rights, which you didn't mention, and that it has to do with the health check of the state of rule of law in the European Union. Because when you repudiate human rights and you repudiate the institutions of democracy, you put rule of law at threat. And this is obviously a concern for us right now, and it's a context in which we're working hard in supporting the EU to strengthen its own tools to monitor and be vigilant with regard to the state of rule of law. Turning to the vehicles to dispel myth, few points here. Firstly, the media continues to play a vitally important role. The media hasn't died. The media hasn't gone away. The traditional, classical, professional media remains enormously important. And we have found time and time again that the media has taken material of ours, has digested it, and has turned it into quite effective messages. But for that to be done better, we need to support media in terms of the skill set to work with human rights stories. Again, that's a concern and a preoccupation of my agency. Another vehicle has to be ourselves. We, the citizen journalists who tweet every day. I think efforts can be made to promote the messaging of human rights through all of us that are out there online. Another dimension that I'd mention is in terms of disseminating the truth and combating the myth, is that we have to do a better understanding within the human rights world of understanding the algorithmic formulae and how they serve their own purposes so that we can outmaneuver there. And look, I maybe there's some really smart people here who are already deep into this, but for most of us, we've only barely begun to understand what an algorithm is and how vitally important it is to grasp it and either create our own alternative algorithms or challenge those that are in use. Last thing I'll say is not so much about who disseminates the message, but about how we all read messages, and again, to promote and protect human rights, we have to invest in media literacy so that the general population is better equipped to go online and sift the nonsense from truth, the provocative fake from the other. And then shrinking civil society space. We did a survey in all of the EU 28 member states. And we found that there are four features, and the composition of the four, or the interplay of the four, differs from country to country. What are those four? Let me see if I can remember them. The first is regulatory pressure, both direct and of a secondary nature, meaning a very legitimate regulatory exercise to control or to make lobbying more transparent. can have an impact for NGO activism, which was perhaps not ever intended by the lawmaker. That's just one example. But regulatory pressures, there's a lot more malign ones as well, of course. Second, many issues around funding. From the most prosaic, which is such that because you work in one of the richest corners of the world, nobody will give you money because they assume that you have access because you live in a rich corner of the world, to the famous prohibitions on foreign funding and then everything in between. So financial pressures. By the way, I won't go on about this, but another huge concern that's familiar to many of you is that project-based funding is not conducive to strong institutions because it tends not to support the core. And so we've got to tackle that in Europe as just about everywhere else. The third area of pressure is lack of access. You're only as good as your ability to access the decision maker. But if the decision maker always has a door shut to you, or doesn't give you meaningful feedback on consultation process, or worse, has completely hollow consultation process, you're not able to do your job. And then the fourth area, sadly, in Europe as anywhere else, is the extent of direct physical attack on buildings and on humans, which in some places it goes uninvestigated. So, as I say, the balance of those four and how they interplay will vary enormously across the European Union, but together they're weakening that civil society voice in a manner which is diminishing the quality of our democracies.
Please, anything you want to add?
I do. I know the question about how the denial of human rights contributed to the rise of populism was focused on the austerity programs, but I'd like to point out, especially here, given all that OSI has done with the former Soviet Union states and the former Eastern Bloc countries, that recently we saw in the German election that the large votes for the most right-wing parties came from what part of the country? The former Eastern Germany, which was formerly the DDR, the East German Socialist Republic. Now, what's my point? My point is that a lot of people have had no experience with human rights. The denial of human rights there has led to a flawed population that doesn't see the value of some of the Western rights. And I think that that's an issue that needs some further attention, how in countries where there was this kind of denial of rights, how populism has a greater appeal. On the question about myths, the biggest myth of the populists is that when it comes to human rights, is rights are only about them, they don't help us. And that's exactly where, as Michael says, education is needed. We need to get the message out better that rights actually do protect everybody, and they do protect the populists as well as the outsiders and the minority elements and the them that they speak about. Finally, on the question of shrinking space for civil society organizations, this is a really serious issue because there are issues of taxation, there's issues of funding, there's issues of organization, registration that are coming back. They're coming back. They never left in many of the Eastern Bloc countries, former Eastern Bloc countries, but they're coming back in many other places where you don't expect them. So how to support this and how to encourage it? We have a problem. When states are saying you can't have foreign funding, or you have to label yourself if you do have foreign funding, like the Hungarian case right now, or Russia, then there's a need to help develop indigenous capacity for support. And that is, that's the work we've all been working on. And we've done a creditable but not a great job in doing that. And we need to reinvigorate those kinds of efforts, it seems to me, and the support for those efforts. Because the I think the biggest fights in over human rights in the first 40 years were about whether individuals, groups, and organs of society have the right to promote, protect universally recognized human rights. That ended up with a declaration saying, yes, you do, which had no mention whatsoever about the funding issue in it, because it was too controversial to be in that. But we have the Human Rights Defenders Declaration. We have a body. We have a mechanism to work about that, work on that at the international level. But we're not doing much at the national levels, or even I would say even at the European level on that issue. So there's a lot of room for activity in this area.
Well, those are great points. I agree completely with your first point, Felice, about the importance of the depth of rights education and knowledge and sympathy in places where there hasn't been as much of a history. On the other hand, I think it is important to keep in mind myself that we are experiencing huge challenges to rights principles and the rights discourse in places like the United Kingdom and the United States, which have prided themselves on having a long rights history, but where growing skepticism exists. Any further questions or comments from colleagues? Yeah.
I'm John Wagner from the International Humanist and Ethical Union. And your point about building alliances really resonated with me, the idea of working, reaching out to businesses and faith groups and arts groups. But the obvious groups you didn't mention are the people who have either no religion or, even more difficult, those who have no religion in particular. And I wonder how you think about engaging those groups in the human rights struggles.
Thank you. To the right, yeah.
Hi, I'm Ken Siegel. I'm wondering, how much is the problem of human rights really rooted in the world's economic inequality and growing economic inequality between the have and the have-nots? 200 years ago, Malthus pointed that out about how the population is outrunning resources. Well, he was talking about food, but now it's resources of all kinds. So that's my question. With the increasing population of the world and the diminishing of fossil fuels and the rest of them and the monocultures that Monsanto is promoting, can the achievement of human rights, a universal program of human rights, really be achieved when most of the world doesn't have anything?
Thank you. One more we'll take.
This is less a question to you than just sharing something that's been going on in my mind that I'm very concerned about and don't know the answers to, so I want to hear from others. My name is Neil Feldman. Originally trained in national security and foreign policy. Now I'm an arts journalist, but one does not forget one's original training and profession. And you touched on this a little bit, populism. And something that I think many people have observed is the extraordinary similarity between, say, Trump supporters in America, supporters of Brexit in Britain and throughout the continent, and the difficulty we have, all of us, in communicating. I am guessing I'm not the only person in this room who doesn't know how to talk to a Trump supporter who has an E-Day fix, and issues of education, facts, but how to appreciate where they're coming from. A goodly number of Trump supporters are not homophobes, racists, etc. Many of them in America voted for Obama twice, but were so despairing of their economic future that they voted for a guy who's going to blow up everything and somehow make something good. And that's, of course, very similar to what's happening in Hungary and Brexit and these other countries. And some help, please, if you will.
Michael.
Thanks. Given the nature and the mandate of my agency, I have colleagues in this room who are telepathically telling me not to respond to what you just said. I'm not sure I could say any more, actually, than I've said already in terms of how we talk with and sit down respectfully with people who don't necessarily agree with us. But we have to do it, because there is no future if we can't find the opportunity for those shared spaces. And in fact, that, to some extent, motivates the importance of the relationship we're building with faith communities. Because it's sometimes the case that the faith leader can can engage in a way where the human rights actor self, you know, so identified cannot. And if there's a commonality of goal there, then what a great achievement. Many years ago, I ran the UN Human Rights Programme in Sierra Leone during the war. And how often, I couldn't tell you how often, it was the Christian and the Muslim leaderships that convinced villages to cooperate with us on this or that. It was the imam and the priest together at a meeting that delivered that achievement in a way I never could on my own. So that's as much as I could usefully say on that. With regard to humanist groups and atheist groups and humanist groups, and you make a perfectly fair point. We also have to be engaged in a dialogue there as well. The European Commission, which is we're independent of the European institutions, one of the most important of which is the European Commission. But under the EU treaties, it is required to engage in a dialogue on a yearly basis with both religiously motivated and humanistically motivated groups in order to promote a Europe based on values. So the bigger EU, I think, does engage, but your point is well taken. And yes, sir, I couldn't agree more with the importance of putting inequality at the top of the agenda. A long time ago, I remember listening to Mary Robinson, the then UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She was asked, what is the single most compelling, most worrying, most primordial human rights abuse that there is in the world? And I remember she said, poverty. And, you know, I've never found a reason since then, notwithstanding everything that's happened since, to disagree with her. The role of poverty in undermining human capacity and social capacity is so obvious it doesn't even need mentioning. And historically, the human rights movement has always treated socioeconomic rights as second best. That's an imbalance that's going to have to get sorted out if we're to have a future.
Thank you. Felice.
Well, there's lots of issues. And I wanted to just draw attention to the fact that in Europe, because of the experience in Europe with populism, National Socialism, fascism, with populism at the beginning of the 20th century and what it led to, and the annihilation of the wars and the annihilation of millions and the economic ruin and the like. The institutions that were built after World War II were designed to make it less likely that there would be a chance for populists to take over. So the governments were constructed in a way that you had to have you couldn't have all the parties in the legislature. You had to have thresholds for some to be represented. There would be somebody else. There were checks and balances along the way. There was a complicated structure created, and it was done deliberately. The irony is that complicated structure is what populists today point to as they telling us what to do. It's what they point to as a complicated system that they have no patience for, and it actually has become the target of the populist groups today. So this is a problem you can't solve overnight. I'm just observing that there are these two things going out of sync: the history, the construction of institutions to deal with that history, and the attack on those institutions. Get rid of the institutions, and you go back to go and do not collect $200. I just think there's a lot of issues here. And on this question of being able to talk to those you oppose, that's what Michael's talking about, bringing together experts who can help you figure out how to message in the same way that they've been able to message with their conspiracy theories, the rigged system, the delegitimized system, they create enemies, and they declare that they represent the common good. We need a better articulation of it. We need better examples of it. We need more vigorous attention to the public education side of human rights. It's always hard to judge and evaluate what it accomplishes. It's a lot easier to go to a court and get a decision and come out and say, you got to do this. But you have to have people willing to respect the rule of law and respect the judgments of the courts, and we just need to rebalance some of our resources and the tremendous intellectual energy in this community in that direction.
I agree completely, and yet I do want to say one thing. It's not so easy to go get a court to say, do this.
Fair, but, fair.
Thank you so much. Michael, last word?
Well, the penultimate word is that I forgot to say something earlier. I was asked to advertise an event tomorrow. It's being organized by the EU delegation to the UN on Muslims in Europe. And I'll be speaking there and presenting our recent findings in considerably more detail than I could today, but there'll be a number of other speakers as well. We have a colleague here from the EU delegation, Marine. Marine is right at the very back, and she has flyers. Maybe if you stand up for a second, just so people can see you. Marine has flyers, so if anybody's interested in attending that event tomorrow, Marine can give you the necessary information. And then the final word, Jim, is just thank you for an invigorating conversation. You know, we're all in the same boat, We need the help of the US-based friends to a considerable degree. We'll only all survive this strange time in world history by cooperating together across continents. Notwithstanding the diversities of our problems, there's a huge amount of commonalities also. So I hope today's conversation is just one part of a strengthened partnership to protect something vital to the future of a civilized society, regardless of which side of the Atlantic we find ourselves.
Very well said. So please join me in thanking Michael and Felice.